Hi, welcome to Holden Village. Today is Monday, July the 24th, 1995. In the fireside room this morning, our speakers are Brad Benow and Ann Palmerton. Their subject, Surprising Parables, Laborers in the Vineyard. Let's listen in.
This is not the roll the tape message, by the way, for the... They know to do that.
My name is Ann Palmerton, and I'm here from Columbus, Ohio, where I'm a Presbyterian pastor at a downtown church there. I've been in that call for 1 month, so far so good. And previous to that, we were from Southern California.
And I'm Brad Benow. I teach at Trinity Lutheran Seminary in Columbus, Ohio, formerly in parish ministry in La Jolla, California, near San Diego. The overall title for the Bible studies this week are Parables, a Foretaste of the Feast to Come. And today's session, we'll be talking about the surprising quality of parables and focusing on one parable in particular, the laborers in the vineyard from Matthew 20, as a typical example of the kind of surprising parable. We also thank the grace for the signing that's going on and the interpretation as we continue the week of emphasis with those who are deaf and hard of hearing. Grateful for that. For those who may have a hard of hearing situation or of any sort, I'll just say it that way. If we're not loud enough, slow enough, clear enough, then you stop us and tell us how to help you be on board with what we're doing. Let's begin then, if we can, with a word of prayer. Lord God, we have heard many times Jesus say that those who have ears to hear will indeed hear. We want to ask for that gift of hearing, that the message might come home to us. Even as we do our asking, we also recognize that we must do our confessing, that frequently the message is there to be heard, but we are those who have fingers in ears. We are those who do not want to understand. We are those who also do not understand brothers and sisters who are gifted differently in terms of their ability to hear, and that inability on our part to be inclusive and outreaching of any sort makes it difficult for all of us, then, to taste this wonderful foretaste of the banquet that's prepared. We ask, then, that in this week, when we think about what it means to hear in different and unique sorts of ways, that we would still be open to being as those who have the capacity to hear and understand, to take this message of parable to heart, to be those who can let this message grow in us, that we might all reach out and be part of a wonderful banquet feast. Bless us as we now draw close to the message that Jesus gives us, for we indeed pray in his name. Amen. Okay. What's up here by way of an outline is a kind of roadmap. We'll try to stay more or less with that. We may not totally stay with that. If you see something there that looks interesting and you'd rather go there than where we are, you feel free to direct that. But it all may also give you a little idea of where we're going and help you judge where you want to jump in, and feel very free to do that. We will ask that, when you want to participate, just raise your hand if you would, so you can be recognized and so we can all know who it is that's speaking, since folks are gifted differently in terms of hearing. That will help a great deal. Let me say a word to get us going here about the aggressive quality of parables, although I put a question mark after that just to indicate that I'm not totally sure about whether this is an accurate way to think about parables, but we're trying this on for size. A few weeks ago, I was at a pastoral theology conference, and a woman made a presentation in a book she's writing about aggression. and everyone sort of blanched, and we think of aggression in rather negative terms. But she was really asking us to open ourselves to rehabilitating the concept and think about what is positive about aggression. And one of the things we realized was that when we talk about aggression as a noun, it's often negative. But if we think about it as an adjective, we warm up to the idea. If you're really sick, you would like to have an aggressive doctor, you know. If you've got legal problems, you generally want an aggressive lawyer. That's a benefit. If you're trying to buy a house, as we've been trying to do in Columbus, you want an aggressive real estate agent. If you're trying to sell a house, you really want an aggressive real estate agent. And so it seems, why not say, do we not want to have an aggressive savior? Someone at this meeting asked this woman this question. Well, what about Jesus? I mean, is Jesus aggressive? You know, that seems, you know, Jesus, gentle Jesus, meek and mild, doesn't fit. But the thing that came home to me is, I think the thing that most distinguishes the messiahship of Jesus was his ability to use parables. This was an absolutely distinctive characteristic of what he brought to the religious community. And there was a sense about how Jesus used these stories that he really moved out against the establishment. And aggression is a word that literally means to step against, to move toward. And I guess we invite you this week, in terms especially of the surprising parables, to think about these stories of Jesus as having an aggressive quality. Not an angry quality. There's a different session today about anger. You can figure out what that means there. But that Jesus really is aggressively trying to undercut people's commonly held expectations about the way that their world works, about the way their religion works, about the way they think he should work, and to provide a very fresh, new, different understanding of all of that. I like that notion of Jesus as an aggressive kind of person, and I don't think we need to feel too threatened by that. Anyway, you can argue with that if you want, but that's where we hope to get ourselves pointed as we go.
And we want to have conversation about that later as the parable unfolds, if you have a spin on that.
Well, I don't. I hope everybody agrees with me.
I'm interested in the conversation. Okay. Yeah. To move on to the unexpected, if we can say anything about the reign of God, about God's work in history and in our world, we can say that it's unexpected. From the Old Testament time of a stuttering young man who was a murderer, leading the Hebrew people on a freedom march, and somehow outwitting the powers that be in the Egyptian hierarchy, that was unexpected. To a savior born not in a palace, but in the simplicity of a farm setting, of a manger scene, that's unexpected. And the parables, the stories that Jesus tells, they challenge our ways of looking at the world. They subvert our expectations, turning things around. Brad and I are both interested in the work of a New Testament scholar called John Dominic Crosan. And he does a lot on this theme of subverting expectations, or reversal, he calls it.
May I interject something? Mm-hmm. I'm a lot less interested in the John Dominic Crosan of late and all of his stuff with the Jesus seminar, if you know anything about that. I'm a lot more interested in the John Dominic Crosan of about 20 years ago when he was writing on parables. But okay. If that makes any sense, that's fine. If it doesn't, forget about it. I don't know where you are on that.
I'm on the 10 years ago. He uses Jonah as an example. The story of Jonah from the Old Testament being like a parable. And this is how he talks about the reversal. Our expectation, as the story is set up, Jonah is a prophet, and we expect a prophet to obey God. That's our expectation. We expect pagans, that is, the people who lived in Nineveh, to disobey God. That's our expectation. Well, what we expect the arrows to go a certain way. But what happens in the story is that the prophet is the one who disobeys God. And the pagans, the Ninevites, are the ones who receive the message and change their ways. And so things are all crossed up in the parables. And Croson says, it's as if this is our reaction to a parable that Jesus says. I'm not sure what Jesus is saying, but I don't think I like it. Okay? Because of the shift, the reversal, the subversion. It's not like we thought at all.
I think we're going to skip the part about parables as allegory, just so we can move on more with this. Well, maybe only to say this, that some parables can be treated as allegories, where this means that, and that means that, and there's a kind of one-to-one correspondence. Most don't work that way. And there have been attempts by some biblical scholars to say no parables are allegories. I don't think you can make that stand up. There are some that are pretty allegorical. The sower and the seed, for instance, because Jesus goes on to, in fact, interpret that as an allegory, has a quality. I think more fascinating are the bulk of the parables, which we've called in quotes here the true parable. That's a term used by Fred Borsch, who's an Episcopal bishop, in his writing on parables. A story that's truly parabolic and not simply an allegory has a more central main focus to it and leaves you at the end with a kind of aha or uh-oh sort of reaction. Sometimes even ending with a question, as is the case with this parable we're going to work with this morning on the laborers in the vineyard. So let's take a look at that. I hope there are enough Bibles around or you're close enough to one. If you want one, they're over here on the rack. This is Matthew chapter 20, the first 15 verses. And I'll go ahead and read this if you don't mind, partly just because for tape ministry purposes it may pick us up a little better. Point one thing out here. You'll notice if your Bible is like my Bible, probably there's a paragraph break at the end of verse 16 of Matthew chapter 20. So the last will be first and the first will be last. Okay, I'm not going to read that verse that says, so the last will be first and the first will be last, having just read it. The parable as Jesus told it probably stopped at the end of what we have as verse 15, and then as a piece of interpretation, the next verse gets added to help say something explained. Jesus said that sentence in other places that are recorded in the Gospels, and we can't be totally sure that it was intended to be an interpretation of this parable. We don't know. But for the purposes of what we want to do, we're going to end with a question, just so we all are forced to think about that a little bit. But here's the parable. Let me lay it in front of us so we can get it refocused in our minds. And I'm reading from the New Revised Standard. You may have something slightly different. For the kingdom of heaven is like a landowner who went out early in the morning to hire laborers for his vineyard. After agreeing with laborers for the usual daily wage, which literally is a denarius, he sent them into his vineyard. When he went out about 9 o'clock, he saw others standing idle in the marketplace, and he said to them, "You also go into the vineyard, and I will pay you whatever is right." So they went. When he went out again about noon, and about 3 o'clock, he did the same, and about 5 o'clock he went out and found others standing round, and he said to them, "Why are you standing here idle all day?" And they said to him, "Because no one has hired us." He said to them, "You also go into the vineyard." When evening came, the owner of the vineyard said to his manager, "Call the laborers and give them their pay, beginning with the last and then going to the first. When those hired about 5 o'clock came, each of them received the usual daily wage, that is to say, a denarius. Now, when the first came, they thought they would receive more, but each of them also received the usual daily wage, a denarius. And when they received it, they grumbled against the landowner, saying, "These last worked only 1 hour, and you have made them equal to us who have borne the burden of the day and the scorching heat." But he replied to one of them, "Friend, I am doing you no wrong. Did you not agree with me for the usual daily wage? Take what belongs to you and go. I choose to give this last the same as I give to you. Am I not allowed to do what I choose with what belongs to me? Or are you envious because I am generous?" Boom, end of story. Now, especially when we end with a question, I think this is one of the especially provocative, surprising things that Jesus is all about. We have to now enter the story. You have to make a decision out of all this about where the story comes to rest with you. I remember this story about a woman who's in a famous art museum looking at some very famous painting, and she's kind of scrutinizing it, you know, can't figure it out. And finally, she just says, "I don't see what's so great about it." And this museum guard who's standing there, you know, all day long, takes all this in and he says, "Madam, it's not up to you to interpret the painting. The painting is here to interpret you." Her comments have revealed much more about her than they have about the painting. And it's sort of that way with parables. Our reaction to the parable says a lot more about us than about saying, "Well, it was a lousy story, you know, and Jesus didn't have a very good day." That's not really the point.
I hope that doesn't cut off discussion.
Well, again, once again, I hope that you all agree with me. Let's see. Generally, Jesus' parables can be grasped as things that were directed at his opponents. You know, those who were not on the same page with Jesus were the ones who were most unsettled by these stories. They were the ones who came away scratching their heads and saying, "And I don't know exactly what he was talking about, but I don't think I like it." And sometimes we then hear they take up stones and try to put him to death or something. What I think we all have to admit is that whether we are in the church or out of the church, whether we consider ourselves being, you know, with the Jesus movement or not, or whatever, we are all to some degree Jesus' opponents. There's part of us that's resistant to the message that Jesus has, even if there's part of us that wants to embrace it. So the parables are for all of us, because none of us are totally, all the time, embrace everything that Jesus, you know, wants us to be. Well, maybe enough said about that. Well, let's move on to some interpretation of all this here, I think.
We're both going to describe some common interpretations or understandings of this parable, and the painful interpretation and the joyous interpretation. In my mind, two sides of the same coin. The painful interpretation goes like this. The workers are grumbling, and the reason for that grumbling is because what happens threatens their existence. And the reason for that is that all of us, through all of these centuries, live with the understanding that the rewards we receive are based on our achievement. That's the way the world works. That's what we're teaching to our three-year-old. It's the way the world works in every area, except in this arena regarding God's nature. If you think about school, if you think about work, we use the phrase climbing the ladder. relationships. I mean, we have conversation about unconditional love, but when it gets right down to it, you know, a lot of times we are rewarded based on our achievements, on what we do. And so the painful interpretation of this parable continues along that line. How uncomfortable I feel when the reward I receive is not based on what I do, but is based on someone else's generosity. Because then I don't control what I receive. And that makes me nervous. And that can make me feel very out of control. And that can lead to an experience of pain or dissonance in my life. Because my own security is challenged. So when the owner says, take what belongs to you and go, this is a kind of dismissal. And some, we read, exclude themselves from the reign of God because of their unwillingness to accept this kind of grace. The difficulty of living in that spot where I can't control what I receive.
I think another way to think about that is that the wrath of God is not just, you know, because God is having a bad hair day or something and he wants to be mean and pick on people or whatever. Whatever that means about the wrath of God has something to do with the fact that when people will not accept God's kindness and God's grace, that's what makes God upset. I mean, you know what that's like. You legitimately try to do something kind for someone, and they say, no thanks, I don't need your help, I'd rather do it myself. And you say, why won't these people let me help? It's never a matter of God kicking anybody, you know, out of the movement. It's a matter of people excluding themselves from the movement sometimes, and God saying, if you won't accept grace, what, I mean, I don't have any more cards to play. That's it. That's the biggest thing I can do. And if you're not getting that point, you know, you're going to be on the outside looking in until that happens. There's a flip side to the painful interpretation, which is a shocking realization that no matter how bad it is, no matter how late we catch on to the meaning of things, God is indeed gracious. You know, this is a hard parable for most of us to hear. Most of us who are fairly well settled, middle class North American types, we've played by the rules. We've done it right. We've done everything we're expected to do. You know. We don't need any grace because our life has been just fine, you know, based on our own achievements. But if you're forced to hear this parable from a different angle, from somebody who's just a late comer and just getting in on things, then it's incredibly wonderful that door is still open. People can enter in that way. In order to jump off now into some discussion. We thought we'd share with you a piece from one of our favorite authors on the parables, Robert Capon, C-A-P-O-N, in his book Parables of Judgment, where he does a treatment of this. And he titles this the classroom teacher's version of the laborers in the vineyard, Matthew 20. This is a modern day, up-to-date interpretation. See where this goes. He starts out this way. He says, remember, it's the classroom teacher's version. Since you have all read the assignment, and then he puts in parenthesis, much eye-rolling, some guilty looks, I shall tell you the story anyway.
There was a man who owned a vineyard. His operation was not on the scale of E. and J. Gallo, but it was quite respectable. Let us put him in the Robert Mondavi class. We first see this gentleman on the evening of the second Sunday in October. September has been a perfect month, hot and dry, bringing the grapes to 20-degree Brie. but his meteorological service tells him that the weather is about to turn into cold soup. So what does our friend Robert do? He gets up first thing Monday morning, goes down to what passes for the local hiring hall, and contracts for as much day labor as he can pick up. Unfortunately, every other grower in the neighborhood uses the same weather reports, so he has to promise higher pay to attract the workers he needs. $120 for the day is the figure that finally guarantees him a crew.
I see a hand up. Yes, Virginia? No, Virginia, $120 is not a ridiculous figure. A denarius was a day's pay. I have simply taken the liberty of making it a good day's pay. A penny a day may have been all right for the translators of the King James Version, but this is 1995. Anyway,
Robert loads his crew into a couple of old school buses and puts them to work. Chop, chop. Just before 9 a.m., though, he gets another wet weather bulletin. They have moved the start of the 3 weeks of rain from Wednesday back to Tuesday. He has one day, not two, to get the harvest in. So out he goes at 9, therefore, and with increasing panic, at noon and at 3, to hire on still more hands. Each time he succeeds in rounding up all the available help, giving them the by now practiced line that he is Robert Mondavi, the famous payer of top dollar, who is also Mr. Fairness himself. Whatever is right, they will get.
It's a huge harvest, though, and with only 1 hour left before dark, Robert realizes he won't get it in on time without still more help. So out he goes again. But the hiring hall is closed by now, and the village square has only its usual crowd of up-to-the-minute losers hanging out in a haze of smoke. You know the types. Lots of leather, some girls and their boyfriends with more moose than brains. Six packs everywhere, and music that ruptures eardrums. What the hell, Robert thinks in desperation. It's worth at least a try. So he walks up to the group, ostentatiously switches off the offending ghetto blaster, and goes into his spiel. He's Robert Mondavi. He's famous and he's fair. They could probably use a buck, so what do they think? What they think, of course, is also, what the hell? Whatever he wants them to do, it won't take long, and whatever he pays, at least it's a couple more six-packs for the night. So off they go.
Now then, run your mind over the story so far. I'm sure you know exactly what happens each time one of those new batches of workers gets dropped off at the vineyard. Before they pick even a single grape, they make sure they find out from the workers already on the job the exact per diem amount on which Robert Mondavi is basing his chances at the Guinness Book of World Records. And since they are, like the rest of the human race, inveterate bookkeepers, they take the $120 figure, divide it by 12, and multiply it by the number of hours they'll be working. Then, and only then, do they lay hand to grape, secure in the knowledge that they will be getting, respectively, $100, $70, $40, and $10.
Robert, however, has a surprise for them. At the end of the day, he is a happy man. With his best and biggest harvest on its way to the stemmer crusher, he feels expansive and a little frisky, so he says to his foreman, I have a wild idea. I'm going to fill the pay envelopes myself, but when you give them out, I want you to do it backwards, beginning with the last ones hired.
Once again, I'm sure you know what happens. When the first girl with purple hair gets her envelope and walks away opening it, she finds six crisp new 20s inside. What does she do?
No, Virginia, put your hand down. She does not go back and report the overage. She just keeps on walking fast.
But when her shirt open to the waist boyfriends catch up with her and tell her they got $120 too, well, dear old human nature triumphs again. They cannot resist going back and telling everybody else what jerks they were for sweating a whole day in the hot sun when they could have made the same money for just an hour's work.
The entail of Adam's transgression being what it is, however, the workers who are on the job longer come up with yet another example of sin. On hearing that Robert Mondavi is now famous for paying $120 an hour, they put their mental bookkeeping machinery into reverse and floor the pedal. And what do they then come up with? Oh, frabjous joy. They conclude that they are now about to become the proud possessors of, in order, 480 or 840, or even, bless you, Robert Mondavi, $1,440.
But Robert, like God, is only crazy, not stupid. Like God, he has arranged for their recompense to be based only on the weird goodness he is famous for, not on the just desserts they have infamously imagined for themselves. Every last envelope they find has six 20s in it. No more for those who worked all day, and no less for those who didn't.
Which, of course, goes down like Gatorade for the last bunch hired, like dishwater for the next to the last hired, like vinegar for the almost first, and like hot sulfuric acid for the first of all. Predictably, therefore, on the lame brain principle that those who are most outraged should argue the case for those who are less so, wisdom would have whispered to them, reply in anger, and you'll make the best speech you ever regret, sweatiest and most exhausted decide to give Robert a hard time. Hey, man, they say, you call this a claim to fame? Those punks over there only worked 1 hour and we knocked ourselves out all day. How come you made them equal to us?
Robert, however, has this speech in his pocket. Look, pal, he says. Incidentally, the Greek word in the parable is hetare, which is a distinctly unfriendly word for friend. In three of its four uses in the New Testament, here and to the man without the wedding garment in the king's son wedding, and to Judas at the betrayal, it comes off sounding approximately like Buster. Look, pal, he tells the spokesman for all the bookkeepers who have gagged on this parable for 2,000 years. Don't give me agitation. You agreed to $120 a day. I gave you $120 a day. Take it and get out of here before I call the cops. If I want to give some pothead in Gucci loafers the same pay as you, so what? You're telling me I can't do what I want with my own money? I'm supposed to be a stinker because you got your nose out of joint? All I did was have a fun idea. I decided to put the last first and the first last to show you there are no insiders or outsiders here. When I'm happy, everybody's happy, no matter what they did or didn't do.
I'm not asking you to like me, Buster. I'm telling you to enjoy me. If you want to mope, that's your business. But since the only thing it'll get you is a lousy disposition, why don't you just shut up and go into the tasting room and have yourself a free glass of Chardonnay? The choice is up to you, friend. Drink up or get out. Compliments of the house or go to hell. Take your pick. Now, you don't applaud us, you applaud Robert Capon. It's his genius. Now, you know, it's a kind of brutally pointed way that he ends that. Okay.
What's the name of the book again?
It's called Parables of Judgment, published by Erdmann's, I think, 1989. Robert Capon, C-A-P-O-N. It may be in the bookstore here, or one of his might be. He has three books called Parables of the Kingdom, Parables of Judgment, and Parables of Grace, which will cover most all of the parables in the New Testament for you. Back to the way he ends that. I mean, it's kind of a brutally honest thing. Compliments of the house, or go to hell. What he's saying in the vernacular there is, it's really your choice about, I mean, I'm not going to send you anywhere. You're going to send yourself to wherever you're going to go. If you can catch on to the idea of the graciousness of all this, you're more than welcome. And if you can't, we don't want you around here spoiling everybody else's fun. There's just no room at the banquet for people who can't enjoy the wonderfulness of it all, which I think is why this really gets to be an arresting story.
Painful.
That's the painful interpretation. When it comes right down to it, I think this is a parable that says to us, challenges us, can we appreciate someone else's good fortune? Or does someone else's good fortune inevitably have to be the cause of our sour disposition? And what Jesus seems to be saying is, if you can't appreciate other people's good fortune, then what I'm talking about as the reign of God and the banquet feast is probably not for you. You'll be quite happier at some other table where they'll let you be miserable. But that's not how I work. You know, that's not the famous and the fair disposition of the owner of the vineyard. Well, okay, where does that leave you? Well, we have good time to talk. Thanks for putting your hand up so we can recognize you. And
just the last thing you said makes me wonder what justice is all about.
Yes.
We're in our society. Some have much, and others have little. And we suspect that it's because, not entirely because the person has less, is lazy or something, but opportunity hasn't always been there, and their circumstances is not always something of their own choosing. And I guess I'm sure that this story was pre-union days, but
yeah.
Pre-what did he say?
Oh, pre-union union days. In fact, I remember one time when we taught this parable, someone said, well, is maybe the meaning of the story is you shouldn't try to unionize against God. But maybe you want to make this point you had from earlier about, you know,
the point about God's care.
Yeah, of the poor. Well, I think when we talked about this before, that one possible interpretation of this story is that, you know, and I'm not sure this is the best, but it's a possible one. Maybe this is an indication that God indeed takes care of the poor. God has compassion for those who wait all day and don't get hired, and there's a way for those people to be brought up to speed and included at the same level as everybody else. That's maybe one way to look. I'm not sure that's a comprehensive enough vision for what this parable means, but that's part of it. But it does begin to ask us to scrutinize this business of fairness and justice. What can be counted on here and what can't? Let's start over here.
Well, people nowadays are screaming because about helping the poor. They say that's not fair. We're being taxed for this and all this. And so, I mean, in a lot of ways, the parables put us uncomfortably in the position of identifying with not the prodigal son, but his brother, not the workers who are hired last, but the workers who are hired first. Where Christ's parables do that time and time again in these kinds of stories. And so we think, I mean, we're committed Christians, or we're, and yet every time we are confronted with that, we find ourselves the prodigal son's brother. We find ourselves the ones that were hired first.
One of the things that we pointed to at our last session, and we will spend time on the parable of the prodigal son and the parable of the elder brother later in the week, but that it's the elder brother in that story who puts the negative moral and sexual spin on what the younger brother has done. There's nothing in the text that reveals that the younger brother had spent time with prostitutes or, you know, that isn't in the text. It's the older brother's projection onto his actions. So in a similar way, our kinds of projections onto those with less.
A lot of people calling themselves Christians are balking about helping the poor these days.
Yeah.
Absolutely, yeah.
I was wondering if one of the problems that we have with this parable is that we think there's a better place to be than working in the vineyard. Yeah. That we're really going to have a much more fun if we're doing something else. And there's this conception in our society that maybe I'll turn to God in my last days when I've got nothing better to do, but for the time being I'm going to have as much fun as I can.
Someone in the first session mentioned about the parallel of the thief on the cross, you know, and I certainly have taught many Bible studies where people say, you know, it's not fair that these people, like this guy on the cross, lived, you know, they lived it up all their life. It's like the older brother says about his younger brother, you know. He's out there having a great time, swell time. I'm, meanwhile, breaking my back, working. Why do we assume that those folks really were enjoying themselves the whole time? No. It doesn't look to me like the prodigal. Really, there's nothing in that story to suggest that he ever enjoyed what he did with the money that he had. He blew it. He certainly clearly ended up miserably. But there's no sense that he says, well, you know, I'm really miserable now that I'm here in this pigsty, but damn, I had a great time. And there's no sense from the thief on the cross that person says, well, I'm in a real fix now, but the living was good while I had... It just doesn't work that way. We assume, we project, like the older brother, that all these other folks are enjoying, whooping it up and enjoying themselves. When in fact, as you're suggesting, isn't maybe the really enjoyable, worthwhile part of life that, hey, you got 12 hours of solid work in the vineyard with really meaningful stuff to do. That's what it's all about. Somewhere we missed the boat on this. And like the older brother, we tend to project and say, what I'm really saying is, I wish I could do some of this other loose living, you know. But it's all fantasy. There's no real enjoyment in that. Yeah,
well, to push it a little bit farther even, if we say that the guys that aren't involved with the Lord are having a better time, why are we? If that looks like the good life to us, why don't we go that way? Are we following the Lord out of some kind of fear of Him or some kind of legalism? If that's the good life, we should all go off and walk it. But somehow we know down deep inside it really isn't. We something has touched us to tell us it is not that.
So like the older brother, we stay there being dutiful but complaining about it every day. but don't have the courage maybe to go for it, because we know deep down, yeah. Don is one of my former parishioners, by the way, who's probably heard me do this parable before. I don't know. Nice to have you here. Exactly. In the back.
I wondered if sometimes our response to this parable has something to do also with, like, our birth order. Because I found myself thinking about sibling rivalry and being the older of two children, you know, seeing how my brother got treated and then I had to do all this stuff he didn't do. And that's kind of what keyed into my mind.
But see, you don't look too messed up. I mean, you had an okay life, probably, right? I mean, your parents did right by you, a little hard, but not unfair, probably, we might say. The story makes us question, as somebody said, about justice and so forth. But the one thing it says is, you can count on God to be fair. It's just that what you think of as fairness and what is God's reality as being fair may be worlds apart. But God doesn't do wrong by you. God just may do differently with the variety of people.
It's also interesting that all of the workers, whether they work 12 hours or 1 hour, get the same gift from the owner.
6/20, yeah.
Right. And I think that might say something about what salvation or grace or being in fellowship with God is. That's, you can't sort of cut it into pieces. You either have it or you don't. You're either in the kingdom or you're not in the kingdom. You either accept grace or you don't accept grace. It's not like you can sort of cut it up into pieces and I have 12 times as much because I work 12 hours or 12 times as much salvation or 12 times as much love of God because I work 12 hours and you work one. It's unquantifiable in a sense. It's a whole thing.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's the point. God's grace works much differently than our reward system in the real world. It's a more absolute form of reward, and that's the only way that could work. And I think that's what we lose sight of. The things that motivate us just in daily life are not what motivates, I think, our spiritual reality.
And this is Bonhoeffer's distinction between cheap grace and costly grace. Cheap grace is much more along the idea of the reward system. Yeah. But truly costly grace, it forces us to think differently, which is hard to do. Yeah, Norman.
One of the things that comes to my mind is we need to learn how to celebrate the new life that a Skid Row bum gets when he comes into the reality of God's grace. We really don't know how to celebrate that, maybe, to share it adequately.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, good point. We had a hand, was it upstairs? Yeah.
Yeah. Go back to this man in the yellow shirt's comment, though, a question about justice. Okay, we have cheap grace, we have fairness, and what about justice?
I've changed my mind.
You raised it already.
Do you want to respond to that? Here's your answer.
I had the same thought when you ended, is this the gentleman who just said, but then I realized, you know, one parable can't cover everything that we have to be concerned about. And the people that were grumbling were those that got the day's wage, not those that didn't have anything at all. It's like, that's probably a whole other subject in this parable. He's saying those of us that got what's fair shouldn't be complaining when someone got what we see is not fair, even though it's a different standard of fairness than we see. So maybe the concept of justice that we're thinking of is not what the parable's talking about at all.
Yeah.
I don't know. Maybe that's all I see.
Another way to say that might be, you know, if I get what's fair and you get what is more than fair, does that all of a sudden make what I get unfair? No. It just means you are the wonderful beneficiary of somebody's largesse and generosity. The question then really devolves back to me, you know, can I deal with that? Or what kind of a problem is that for me? There is this really interesting consistency among characters in the parables, like these people hired first, like the older brother in the prodigal son, like the person in the story of the wedding feast that reading from Capon alluded to. You may remember that story. The guy comes to the wedding feast. There, each guest is to put on a garment when they come in. That was the custom. The host had a whole rack of wonderful clothes for you, and you got to put on something nice. And here comes this guy who apparently doesn't put one on because he gets in and then the host of the party says, "Where's your garment?" You know, apparently the guest wanted to say, "I don't need this. I'm fine just as I am. I don't need your grace. I don't need your charity," etc. That became problematic, and he got kicked out of the party. The question begins to be in a lot of these parables: can we deal with the generosity and the grace, or not? Here's where the parable starts to interpret us. And often, rather uncomfortably, I think. There were some more hands up back there, Eleanor.
And isn't it true that the parables are about the kingdom of God and about God's behavior and attitudes toward us, rather than how we should each run our hardware store? You know, is that right? That the parables are about the kingdom and God's activity, not necessarily how we should run our businesses.
Yep. Yeah, that's the point of why these are not necessarily moral stories or moral parables. If Jesus had wanted to talk morality with people, he just could have said, "Here's the Torah, you go home and read Leviticus." That's it, pretty much. It's all the morality you need. Jesus somehow felt a need to put a new framework around Torah to give people a new and expansive vision of how God was unfolding the meaning of all that. Right. That's one of the reasons we'll talk about the parable of the Good Samaritan. Why that is not a morality play about being kind to the disadvantaged. The question is, how do you relate to the Samaritan, who you hate, you know, for lots of ancient reasons, who has basically shown you up as being your moral superior? That's why, you know, we're working that is a parable about envy, which interestingly shows up at the end of this story also in the New Revised Standard. Are you envious because I am generous? These parables call into question our response of envy for someone who is better off than we are. Yeah. Upstairs? Or oh, back.
Yeah. Hi. I was just thinking about fairness, and it seems to me that, I don't know about other people, but I tend to equate that with equity, with equality, and that gets to be very problematic in a parable like this, where God's surprising grace, or the vineyard keeper's surprising grace, is to not be equal, and yet to be completely fair. Mm-hmm. And I just kind of like the difference between that. And I wondered whether either of you, Anne or Brad, had a comment on maybe juxtaposing, I like Bonhoeffer's cheap grace, costly grace, and whether you could incorporate that with the idea. I don't know what I'm getting at, but I think with equity, and what's equal is not necessarily what's fair. If anybody has any thoughts on that.
Here's your answer, I think.
Yeah.
Well, I was thinking of, when you talk about Bonhoeffer, it's tough being a Christian in Nazi Germany and Soviet Russia. It's relatively easy being one in this country, given. And I think that it also says that it's important that we, you know, try to be fair to people, to make sure that everybody has what they need. But there's a, and she makes a good distinction between fairness and equity, but there's some, at some point where it becomes problematic and it breaks off, and we have very limited notions of fairness. The parables, parable like this one, maybe helps us deal with what we see as an inequity. They teach us that life finally is to us unfair. So how do we deal with that? And the parables help us do that, and also show that there is a way of dealing with that, and that's through God's grace too. So I think the parable works on the psychological level, helping us accept our fate to a degree. I'm a Christian in Nazi Germany. How do I accept that fate? You know,
I wonder, we didn't talk about this, but the idea of the abundance mindset and the scarcity mindset, that it depends on how you look at the world. Is there enough to go around, or is there a shortage such that everybody's got to get what they can get, because there might come a time when there's not enough to get? Does that make sense? We didn't deal with that in terms of this parable, but we've talked about this before.
Right, we've talked about this in terms of our marriage.
Yeah, right.
This is on tape, so.
It's very true. I grew up, I think, in a well, this is my stuff for next week, in a sense. We're talking about family of origin issues, and the problem with parents is they had parents. Okay. And for generation after generation, certain mindsets cultivate. But you can say the same thing about any church congregation as a family, that, you know, ideas and mindsets get handed on. But I grew up in a family where there was more the attitude of scarcity. And so I tend to treat money and possessions with a kind of scarcity mindset, whereas I think you
right.
recognize the more abundant attitude.
So there will be enough, there's always enough, it'll be okay.
But this is also fundamentally, I think, a male-female difference. Some feminists have pointed out that women seem better able to deal with the abundant. That it's not, you know, there's only so much power or authority to go around, and if you get too much, I don't have enough. You know, there's enough for everybody. And I think what the parable challenges us to see is, just because somebody else is the beneficiary of graciousness, doesn't mean inevitably that I have to get cheated. I'll get everything I need. It's fine. I'm really well taken care of. Thank you very much. But we get so threatened because somebody else gets a little more. Doesn't need to be. Yeah, David.
One of the things I see maybe is going back to the Garden of Eden. It's our problem of once we get into this garden, you know, we think that we know how to run things better. Once we've been in the vineyard, you know, we're just hired as workers, but we can run things better than the owner. And Jesus saying, well, the vineyard belongs not to you, but to the owner. And the owner ultimately will do what the owner wants to do, whether you like it or not.
Yeah. Back here.
Yeah, another thing I was thinking about from the owner's perspective is that you can make a parable about getting hired at 6 and 9 and noon and whatever. As you keep getting chances again and again and again and again to get right. And at the owner's perspective, he wants to hire people. And the people that he hired first were probably the people that were up since 5 in the morning and ran to the front to get hired. And the people that got hired at 6 were probably still in bed. And there's a, you can think of it as a parable. They get a chance and another chance and another chance and another chance. And what's important to the person who owns the vineyard is that he hired it eventually.
Yeah. Yeah.
And that's what he's interested in.
And as Don said earlier, if the folks who showed up at 5 in the morning really think these other folks have such a great lifestyle, then why don't they sleep in? You know, there's something about them that says, no, this I need to really be about it early on. But then why complain? You did what you thought was right and faithful, and you're well taken care of. Nobody's cheated you. Why the big stink? Yeah. Let's see. Anybody? Yeah. Go back over here.
Yeah, the feeding of the 5,000 kind of plays into this too. I mean, there's been explanations going around as to what happened there, and you know, we can talk about those. But I think one of the explanations I heard is actually the people came there thinking they didn't have enough to eat, and in fact, everybody had enough to eat. And when they saw that the disciples were willing to share just a few loaves and fishes. That's all they have. They're willing to share that with all of us. Well, then I can do that too. And they probably brought out that big loaf of bread they had hidden, squirreled away somewhere. And pretty soon everybody had enough. I mean, there is something in there about, in the this parable about, I think, our perceptions. And I think that's why I like that interpretation of feeding the 5,000, which is a kind of a, in a sense, functions like a parable.
I always like the Franco Zeffirelli version, you know, in Jesus of Nazareth, where you ever notice, there's no flies on the fish. I can have all those fish out there in the middle of Palestine in the hot day, no flies. Well, it's 10 o'clock, and I think that's our time we have to break. Let me just leave you with this thought, which maybe is a jumping off point to the rest of the week, too. Crosson talks about Jesus, the person of Jesus, as God's parable. Meaning that in the end, we ended this diagram here about how our expectations get crossed up, and just a bit of a play on words, perhaps. That all these parables do eventually point us to the cross, which is, in a sense, the ultimate parable. The ultimate subversion of our expectations about the way that things work. That victory is gained by submission and death. That vulnerability is the way to a triumphant reigning. It is not the way we are conditioned to expect things. The person of Jesus goes so much against the grain of everything that people then and now expected and wanted a Savior to be. That to embrace Jesus really is to get into a parabolic mindset where we get used to the unexpected. And we get used to saying, it just doesn't work quite like I thought it would work. Our expectations get subverted, which all is to the purpose of throwing us back on the grace of God, so that eventually we do come away, as Anne said at the very beginning, scratching our heads and saying, it isn't like I thought. And it's pretty natural then to say, and that makes me